Okay, this is the 14th of May, 2013, and I'm doing an interview for the African Studies Oral History Archives with Joellen Fair, Professor of Communication...
Journalism and Mass Communication.
Journalism and Mass Communication. And here we go. I would suggest kind of starting at the beginning, Joellen, and telling the microphone and me a little bit about where you grew up and maybe something about what your parents did and how you got on to a kind of academic track in life and that kind of thing.
So stop me if I get too long-winded, and stop me if I'm not clear or ask me to clarify.
Okay, will do.
I was...
Excuse the Velcro sound.
Oh, no problem. I was born in 1960, so this year I will be 53. I was born in West Lafayette, Indiana, where my father was finishing up college.
I taught at Purdue for a year.
Yeah, oh, really? Okay. Yeah. So he was finishing up college at Purdue University, and the only reason my dad went to college was because he was on a football scholarship.
Really?
Yeah, so he didn't play a lot when he was at Purdue, but
enough,
it was
enough to have a scholarship.
Where he had a scholarship. Otherwise, I don't think he would have gone to college.
How about your grandparents?
My grandparents did not go to college. Yeah. Neither set of my grandparents went to college. And my parents were married at that point all through college. In fact, they got married when they were in high school, seniors in high school.
Oh, yeah.
And that's very southern Indiana. They were married in high school. My father went off to college at Purdue University. And I was born soon after he graduated. But he went to college, as I just said, because he had this scholarship, and my mother didn't go to college at that point, at least, because she was a married woman, she was a woman, and her parents were not going to pay for her to go to college if she were already married.
And she was not offered a football scholarship.
No, and she was not offered a football scholarship. But education for my father was not something that was really important. What he wanted to do and what he did do after he graduated was he taught in schools. He taught science and he taught phys ed in high schools. But mostly what he did was he coached football. That's why he went into education, not because he was an educator in the classroom. He was an educator on the field. I mean, that's really what he was interested in doing. And a few years after I was born, and I remember this as a kid, when my mother went to college herself, we were living in Indianapolis by that time, and she couldn't stand it that my father had a degree and that she didn't. And she also very much did not want to be a stay-at-home mother. I remember as a kid thinking, that's good, because to have her at home was not... fun.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So she got a bachelor's degree from what was then called Indiana Central. I think it's now University of Indianapolis. And she taught elementary in elementary school. Mm-hmm. So both my parents were teachers of sorts. I think, but neither of them really had, I don't know if it's sounds too full of oneself, but there was no sort of, they weren't interested in intellectual pursuits.
Yeah.
My mother would read novels. I've never, ever seen my father read a book. In fact, I don't think he probably reads very well at all, is my guess.
Yeah.
When you talk to him about his college years, it's mostly about how... the football athletic department made sure that football players got through what they needed to get through for academic purposes.
Yeah.
And my mother really just, her degree was purely utilitarian. She wanted to not be at home all the time. She wanted to earn some money. And this is what women could do. You were either a nurse or a teacher,
Right.
Those are her two choices, and so she chose teaching.
Yeah.
So I didn't. When I think of how I grew up and sort of my formative years, I think of myself as being working class, even though my parents have college educations.
Yeah, yeah.
The rest of my family does not. Mm-hmm. And my parents didn't see their college educations as really being, it was a means to an end, and that end was to get some kind of job.
Yeah.
So I saw myself as, and we grew up in a very working class area in the south side of Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I wasn't encouraged. I loved math and science when I was in middle school and high school, but I could not do the math. And so that meant I could not continue in the science, or when I did, I had to work extra hard. But this was of an era when you didn't get kids tutors if they were having difficulty,
yeah,
you know, with a subject. And my parents certainly weren't going to get a girl a math tutor, because as my father would always say, well, when you get married, your husband will take care of math for you, so you know, take care of balancing the checkbooks, and you won't need to worry about it. So that was that. When I got into high school, it was clear to me that I wanted to go to college, but my parents weren't particularly interested in that. They thought it was an okay idea, but they weren't really sort of talking to me about what college is to go to. I had two choices in state schools, either Purdue, which is where I ended up, and that it was clear that if they were going to help me out at all with paying tuition, that was really my only choice,
mm-hmm,
or Indiana University.
Yeah.
So there was no idea, no sense of going outside of the state for college, because it just wasn't seen as necessary. College wasn't seen as necessary. But I knew I wanted to go, and I knew from middle school and even younger that I was really quite interested in history. And, since science and math were obviously not what I was going to be able to do, I was very interested in history.
Did you read a lot on your own?
I read a lot on my own. So much so, I remember my grandmother, when I would be down there staying with them, and I stayed with my grandparents a lot during the summers because my brother had a heart condition, and my parents had to take him out to Boston Children's Hospital quite often.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be, during the summer months, very often at grandparents' homes. And my grandmother just said, reading too much, it's not good for women to read that much. It's going to put funny ideas in your head.
Ruin your eyes.
Yeah, ruin my eyes, the whole bit. And in fact, she would hide books on me so that I couldn't read when I was down there. I don't know what I was supposed to do, because it was a small hick town with about 100 people in southern Indiana. But apparently I was supposed to be doing something more interesting, at least to her mind. The other part of who I was in high school was that I was a very good swimmer, won a state championship, that sort of thing. Had an opportunity, I probably could have gone maybe to Purdue or Indiana on a swimming scholarship or a partial swimming scholarship at that point, but I just saw that as interfering with academics, and so I wasn't interested in doing that. Now, my parents were very interested in me doing that, because then, you know, that would relieve them. Our sort of deal was that I would work and pay for most of my school, and they would chip in, you know, parts of dormitory, living in the dormitory and so forth. So they saw this as a great deal for them that, you know, I would...
Well, they also probably saw the athletic talent as a important thing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, and that's my father's life,
yeah,
right? You know, so why, he couldn't understand why I wouldn't want to continue with something like that. But, you know, I just figured swimming is a really hard sport to participate in. You have to train all year long, and you have to train in the morning and train in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just also at the time where it was decided that women could lift weights.
Mm-hmm.
Because before, in high school, we started to lift weights a little bit, but it was really uncertain whether that was going to be bad for reproductively for girls to lift weights as a way of training.
Oh.
But I just saw swimming as I'm not going to go professional in swimming. I'm not going to go to the Olympics in swimming. It's just because of how much you have to train, it's just going to get in my way of doing well in school. And I really wanted to do well in school because I remember very clearly in eighth grade sitting on the bus waiting for the bus to leave the school and to go home, thinking the only way I'm going to get out of South Side of Indianapolis is through school, and unless I do well, unless I can get to college, you know, I'm stuck here, and I don't want to be stuck here. I don't want to live here for the rest of my life, and so, you know, that's it's funny, but that always sticks out in my mind. Mm-hmm. It was right at my last class in eighth grade was in history, world history. And so I was just kind of, I think, sitting on the bus thinking about what we'd been reading about, which was India that day, and thinking, I want to travel, I want to know things, I want to see things. I don't want to live in Indiana, the south side of Indianapolis, or in southern Indiana. I've got to get out of here.
Yeah.
And that created, I think my parents felt that because I was always reading and I was always concerned about issues in the newspaper and watching the news and that sort of thing. That there was some tension there that I was maybe a little bit too, that I thought I was too good for the family, or that I was a little bit more self-important than what I should have been. And then I decided I wanted to go to college, began to push for going to college, figure out how to fund going to college, figuring out with them what they would pay for, what they wouldn't pay for. And they made it hard. They didn't particularly want me to go. They thought maybe I should go to IUPUI, which was a small campus downtown Indianapolis, and just live at home. They thought very much that I should be a dental hygienist. That wouldn't mean that I would need to go to college. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine me as a dental hygienist. My hands shake. That would have been just the worst, but they had lots of ideas that women could do that didn't require college. My mother wanted me to practice typing all the time so that I could be a secretary or something like that. And that's not what I had in mind.
So?
I went to college.
Yeah.
I wanted to
Where'd you go?
I went to Purdue University because that was my only choice. That was if my parents were going to help me out.
In-state tuition.
In-state tuition. And if they were going to help me out at all, that was going to be...
What about Bloomington that actually has a very strong African studies
program? It does, but my father played at Purdue.
Okay.
And Indiana University was the major rival of Purdue University in the state. Uh-huh. And... they made it very clear that if I wanted any support from them, and I funded about 75% of my own school, and they funded a quarter of it, maybe a third, that if I wanted any help at all, this is what I was going to go do.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to be a history major by that point, and that was also something that was just not going to happen because their view of college or university was you went to university to get yourself a job.
Yeah.
It was a way of getting the credentials to get a job, and you didn't get a job in history. And therefore, I was not going to be a history major. Now, this is, I think, before the era where kids had two and three majors. No one thought of that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it was decided that communications might be okay because I could learn how to write and I could maybe work public relations. Journalism was not something that was considered for me. But I could work in public relations or do corporate relations or something like that, and that would be okay. So communications was seen as being professionally oriented enough that was an acceptable major. And that's how I got into communications. Not at first because of any real interest, but because if I wanted to go to college and take all the other courses that I wanted to take, then that was what I needed to do.
And Purdue had a program.
Purdue had actually a good communications program back then. It was not bad at all. It was okay in social studies. So I did take lots of history courses and lots of sociology courses, and so I feel like, and women's studies courses, so I feel like I got a nice broad liberal arts background despite my parents.
Yeah.
So.
And then graduate study?
Yeah, graduate school. I went on to graduate school because I didn't know what else I could do. I did not want to go work in public relations or something like that. I just couldn't think of anything more horrible than that. I did not want to go to law school or something like that. And that was just only kind of opening up then for women. And grad school seemed like a far-fetched idea also to my parents. And even though my grades were very, very good, and it just seemed incredibly far-fetched. But I did apply to graduate school just because lack of imagination. I couldn't think of what else to do.
Yeah.
And I did think about trying to switch fields and go into history. And then, you know, at some point you become very pragmatic. You know, so I thought, history, I don't know. I wasn't trained as an undergraduate. Now you understand that it wouldn't have mattered. But back then it seemed more insurmountable than what it was. So I went into communications in graduate school as well. And then I went to Indiana. And why Indiana? For no particular good reason, it was a good program. But it was mostly because Indiana gave me the most funding. I wanted to go to Minnesota, and I wanted to go to Wisconsin. Those were my two top choices.
Oh,
and I had been accepted to both programs, but they didn't give me nearly as much funding as Indiana did. So I thought, well, my parents were not going to help out at all with graduate school with funding for that. So I thought, I've got to go where I don't rack up a lot of debt. And so that's why I went to Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I was there, I was always interested in international issues, and so I knew I wanted to do something with international communications. I thought at the time, because of I was in a relationship with and we eventually married in graduate school. But my husband then was from India originally, and so I thought we had this romantic idea that we would both do work on India and go back and forth to India. And I took Hindi classes and always a terrible language student, but I took Hindi classes and did that sort of thing, and we did field work in India, and that's where, you know, I thought that's where I'll go. It happened in graduate school that I took a number of classes with Patrick O'Meara.
Oh, yeah.
And
O'Meara was
he was the director, long-term
of director
of the
African Studies
program.
Yeah.
And so I took a number of courses in political science and history and sociology with people who were doing work on Africa. And so I got really interested in Africa, but I didn't do any language training because I was doing the Hindi and thinking I would work in India, so I didn't actually ever go at that time. It just didn't seem, you know, it was just interesting, and I enjoyed reading and writing about it, but it was just this kind of secondary interest.
Yeah.
And I finished graduate school.
Where are we in time now?
Oh, gosh, where are we in time? About 1988, I think. I wasn't quite 20. I think I was 27 then. I was almost 28.
Uh-huh.
So it would have been 1988. My husband had a job at Iowa State University in Ames.
Yeah.
And I'd finished up, but they promised me they'd hire me as a lecturer for a year, and I thought that was good enough. And we were in Ames for a year. It was in the middle of nowhere. I felt like it was very windy and flat. And so I was there for a year as a lecturer. There was a job posting for a position here at Wisconsin. Wisconsin had always been, you know, the dream job. The
oh,
one.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, well, there were two people who were doing international.
Has a very good reputation.
Very good reputation. Mm-hmm. In not only in my field in communications, but across campus and all the social studies and humanities disciplines. And there were two people in the School of Journalism who were doing international-related work. Bill Hackton, who was in the African Studies program, and who did a lot of work on press censorship in Africa. And then another guy named John McNally, who did a lot of work in Latin America. Mm-hmm. And they were also, at the point, I'd gotten to know them through conferences, and I also knew that they were kind of wrapping up their careers here, that there would be retirements, and I was waiting for them to re-retire, because I really wanted to apply for the positions here. And so Hackton did retire the year that I was in Iowa State as a lecturer. And I applied for that
By the
position.
Way, Crawford Young interviewed Bill Hackton.
Yes, he
in
contacted
his
me.
He
contacted me to get Bill's contact information. I haven't seen Bill in ages. So I applied for the job. And I came up here for an interview like in March or so. It was cold, that's all I remember. But the other part, the other complication was I was also pregnant. And because I figured if I'm gonna be in Ames, Iowa, we might as well start a family because there's nothing else to do in Ames, Iowa, and doesn't look like, you know, I'm gonna work as a lecturer forever, so why not? Have a family now. So this job came open, I applied for it, I got interviewed, and I was pregnant. And I was only maybe a couple months pregnant or 3 months pregnant, something like that. But I was sick as a dog. I had morning sickness all day long, every day for 3 months. And I came up for the interview. I drove up, and it was freezing cold, and I was sick. And I thought, you know, I really don't care. I just, you know, I had my job talk. My only goal for the interview was not to throw up in anyone's office. I mean, the bar was pretty low. I mean, I really just thought if I don't throw up in someone's office as they're interviewing me, this is going to be a good job interview. I mean, I was just, and I was tired, and but the interview must have gone well. I'm teased by colleagues on two accounts now. One, that I had grits for breakfast. For some reason, they took me to the union for breakfast, and the union had grits. Why in Wisconsin the union had grits, but it had grits that morning, and that was the only thing that I thought I could eat. And so I had like two huge bowls of grits for breakfast, and the colleague still thought, he'll tease me about it from time to time about how weird that was. You know, she ate two bowls of grits for breakfast. And then the other part, after you go and you have your job dinner and people use it as an excuse to eat and drink on the state's dime, and so, but I couldn't drink. And so there was a little concern. Was I a teetotaler? Was I one of those? I could just see it. And so I mentioned that I had been having the flu and I was on medication, and that's why I couldn't drink anything. And that was then all okay. You know,
sort of relief.
Relief that, okay, if we hire her, she's not going to be one of those, whatever that is exactly. So I got the job. Of course, I did not tell anyone in my department I was pregnant until we concluded that I was going to take the job and that my husband and I would move up here. So I came up here in the fall of 1989. I was teaching a beginning reporting class, and I taught an international communication
class. Had you had
your
baby by that time?
No, I did not have. This is back in the days, too, where there was no stopping the tenure clock because of childbirth. There was no health care for 6 months. So you had to pay your own health insurance for 6 months. And so I wasn't due until the middle of October. So I had, of course, I had to pay my own health care insurance. So there was that. There was also this whole teaching two new courses and trying to figure out how I was going to have a baby in the middle of the semester, and how if I was going to be able to get back, and when I'd be able to get back, and how was my department going to handle that in terms of pay and all this kind of stuff. And the department had never had to deal with this before. Apparently, no other female faculty member had ever had a baby, apparently, or not one during the academic year. And why I was first here in that first semester, they also rolled out the plan that you could ask to have your tenure clock stopped for a year if you were having a baby. That was the only context in which you could. Now there are lots of reasons why one can have the tenure clock stopped for a year. But that was back then, it was women in childbirth. And so I thought, great, I'm going to do that. And my department chair said, oh, no, no, you're not going to be seen as a serious scholar if you do that. But he was not a serious scholar himself, so I went ahead and I did that. I petitioned to have my tenure clock stopped for a year because of my daughter being born. But that was a very odd time. You know, Donna Shalala contacted me when I first got up here because I was big and I was pregnant, and she had me go down to the state legislature and be part of a hearing on paying new UW employees health insurance and why that was so important. And I was a good symbol because here I was, this hugely pregnant woman, and I could say, but you know, I'm not making any money. I had to pay for my own moving costs. You know, I had to pay for half my computer in my office. I have to pay for my health insurance, and you know, so I felt like I was sort of at both for the health insurance and for the stopping of the tenure clock. I was one of the earliest people to get involved. In doing that. So that that felt, I think, useful and good. My husband then, there was the other retirement of the other faculty member who did international communication that year. And so my husband applied for his job. And we're back in the day where there wasn't spousal hiring. In fact, the university was very skeptical of hiring couples.
It was illegal in older times.
It was not illegal, but it was still frowned upon. And especially in the same department, that seemed to be and so that was a semester I had to do a lot of sort of background, in the background, negotiating, trying to talk people into seeing that this was not going to be a problem. You know, just a lot of, having to try to do what I can do to help get my husband hired. And he was a good candidate, but even as a good candidate, it still wasn't clear that they would have hired him. But in the end, they did. So we both had tenure track jobs in the same department at Wisconsin. And, those are also, so that was also just something that was quite different because of getting a spouse hired, especially one in the same department, and kind of teaching the same kinds of things. He later sort of moved into another direction in his research.
And I guess you did too.
And I did too. So in the end, that all worked out. But it was hard to convince people how we were going to be distinct from each other and what we could offer the department as distinct and people, persons, and scholars. So that first year, I don't remember much about it. I remember having a 2-3 teaching load. I remember
With the new baby.
With the new baby, I had a 2-3 teaching load, and a new kid, and a husband trying to get a job. And also, all the other frustrating, new, and scary things when you're a professor. My international communication course had 150 students in it, so it was a large lecture class. I'd never supervised a TA before. I'd never done a huge class like that. I was breastfeeding, so it was all these complications that. So that was And it was also about that time, at the end of that second semester, so spring of 1990, Betty Wass got in touch with me. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, you were hired for Bill Hackton's job. And I said, yeah. And she said, well, then you should be an Africanist. And she said she had apparently run into Patrick O'Meara someplace, and he had alerted her that I was at Wisconsin and that I took a bunch of classes with him and other Africanists at Indiana. Mm-hmm. And so why not recruit me into African studies? And Betty knew that I had been hired for the Hackton job. And so...
Were you also in the, because of your earlier work, were you in the South Asian Studies program?
No, because I it was my first year. I had barely time to figure out what I was doing. I mean, I just had no sense of anything other than getting to classes, getting my classes prepped, trying to figure out how to be a faculty member and a mom and, you know, all the...
What is your daughter's name again?
Mela.
Did you bring Mela to the campus with you usually?
I did sometimes. Yeah, we were able to find someone. We could take her to this woman's home, and that's you know, during the days when we weren't teaching is where she would stay. But on days that I wasn't teaching, she would be home with me. Uh-huh. Now that didn't work the same for my husband. He got to go in every day.
Yeah.
But that's also the era, right? So I took care of her on days that I wasn't teaching, and then we had... Uh-huh. So that was also another sort of trying to figure all that out, too. What was your question again? Did I answer it? I can't remember.
Well, I just asked about Mela.
Yeah, so I did bring her in sometimes, and that was also... kind of appalling to some of my, especially older male colleagues. Well, what are we doing now? Babysitting too? Daycare center. This was seen as being not a new good development for the department.
I don't know. Do you want to maybe say a little bit about the development of your academic interests?
Both
in, you know, journalism and mass communication, and maybe also how you really got deeper into African studies.
Well, it was Betty. Mm-hmm. Betty contacting me and saying, why don't you come over and talk to me about what we do in African studies? You know, I talked to Patrick, and I know you were hired for Bill Hackton's job, so why don't you come over and talk to me about what we do? And I did that, and she said, well, we're starting these State Department linkages, one with the University of Jos in Nigeria.
Yeah.
And I remember that's how I also came to meet you, because you had lived in Jos.
Yeah.
And so I remember talking to you about Jos
and
what that would be like to work in Nigeria.
Yeah.
Doing that, and she said we might have linkages later on with Senegal, and I had studied French in college, and that was one of my second languages for when I was a PhD student. I'd never spoken French. Uh-huh. I'd never spoken a word of French anywhere.
Yeah.
I could read it well, but I'd never spoken it. But he said, don't worry about that. You know, it'll all work out.
Yeah.
So I came over to talk to her, and she said, we've got these linkages, and we want to send you, and whatever it takes to provide you with the knowledge and the experience so that you can be part of the program and feel good about being part of the program, that's what we want to do.
Yeah.
And so she really worked on helping me to participate in these linkages, and connected me with people on campus that I could talk to about what should I be reading, what should I know about. I remember having long conversations with Crawford Young and Harold Schwab and Linda Hunter and Rich Ralston and you and other people about, you know, do I want to be a West Africanist, a Southern Africanist, you know, what part do you where do I want to work, what language should I study, you know, should I study a language, what do I do? It was really through the African Studies program that I decided, you know, I really am interested in questions about how journalists talk about Africa or write about Africa. How did I get onto that? Someone from another university, for whatever reason, I don't know, asked me to write a chapter for a book. And I was asked to write about media images of Africa. Uh-huh. And I thought, well, yeah, I can do that. You know, my work on for my dissertation, I kind of plumbed it, you know, as much as I could for journal articles, and so I was tired of that, and so I was kind of thinking about what do I do next, and I got this book chapter request, and I thought, oh, well, I've been talking to Betty Wass about this stuff, and I got this request to write this chapter, and that's, it sounds facile, but that's really how I got into the first part of my scholarly life when I came up for tenure, was working on thinking about representations of Africa, both in popular culture, but also in news media.
Yeah.
And I was also, because of my husband's work, he was doing more work on representations of race domestically. And so I got interested in questions of race as it pertains to how Africa is also represented. Because one of the things I had noticed was that a lot of American language about race was also part of journalistic telling of stories about conflict in Africa or understandings of Africa.
Yeah.
And so I was really interested in the way that that American journalists used American racial tropes as a way of explaining events, particularly conflict or disease, famine in Africa. And so the next several years, I did a lot of work looking at news representations of famine in the Horn of Africa, looking at conflict in terms of descriptions of race and ethnicity, but mostly the way that Americans talked about it in terms of really race rather than ethnicity. That's what I started to just, that's what I came up for tenure on, is that body of work that looked at that in various ways and looked at different patterns of that. And then Betty, as I was sort of coming up for tenure, was sending me off to Nigeria and Senegal and other places, and I thought, okay, so once I get this tenure thing done, And I felt pretty confident that I could get tenure. I was doing work that was completely different from anyone in my department. My department their research tends to be very quantitative. People tend to use a lot of surveys to understand how do people feel about the coverage of this or that, you know. And so it tends to be very survey-oriented, or it tends to be experimental. You know, so what's the effect of children watching violent cartoons? You know, how much do their palms sweat, or you know, something like that.
Right.
So I was doing what they perceived to be as very strange work that was very cultural studies oriented, and you know, doing post-structuralist theory, and this is not what my department did. The historians and people who were doing legal studies in my department were very supportive because they also felt like outsiders in that department. And so one person in particular, Robert Drexel, really was within the department. This is also the days when assistant professors didn't have mentors. So he was my unofficial mentor in the department. And he was really very, very supportive of the work that I was trying to do and the way that I was trying to integrate myself more into African studies and to join this community and the kind of reshaping that I had to do as a scholar to be able to do that, because the program as a doctoral student that I came from was also very quantitative. And the work that I'd done for my dissertation didn't have anything to do with what I was doing. So I had to really reinvent myself when I came here to do more cultural studies work. And so he was very supportive and sort of helping me think how to do that and where to publish. I wanted to be in the humanities division, and my department said, no, we don't do that. You know, everybody comes up through social studies. That's just what we do. And you're not going to write books. You're going to write articles because that's just what we do. We don't know how to do any bring up someone through for tenure through humanities. So don't even ask about that. So in my third year review, I was a little worried that I was going to have people reading my stuff who clearly were not going to understand or appreciate what I was trying to do. So I talked them, or actually Bob Drexel talked them into doing a small external review of to get people from the outside of the university. And someone, maybe it's even Rich Roston, I can't remember now, but maybe someone from the African Studies program here read some of my work, and then we had someone from the outside, from another university who read some of my work and could say, yes, it's good, it's high quality, it's interesting, it's, you know, it may not be exactly what you guys do, but, you know, it, this is good work, you know, don't, you know, let her go, let her do what she wants to do. And it was after that third year review where I came in very positive that I just thought, I can do this tenure thing. And I was not going to fail at getting tenure because I was not going to prove my parents that I shouldn't have gotten into this whole academic thing. When I was interviewing for academic positions, I mean, I remember my mother showing me some book that says, look, the ratings for professors is very low. You don't get paid. There's no job security. It's, you know, it's this is a terrible life. You don't want to do this. You know, it's still time to do something else. Dental hygiene school, maybe. But I was not going to fail at tenure because I was not going to prove them to prove them right. That was not going to happen. So when I was working on tenure, I did talk. People like Harold Schwab were fabulous at spending time with me. I'd come in with some question or want to talk about some reading, some book I'd been reading. And he would sit and talk to me about that sort of, you know, whatever it was that I was thinking about or reading. Rich Ralston, I don't know, I felt like he kind of adopted me. I get these phone calls, let's go to lunch. And we'd go to lunch and we'd talk about what I was working on and his thoughts about what I should do and and how to negotiate this or that on campus. And and so, you know, they were really wonderful. To me, and in those ways, Crawford, I was always a little afraid of, but every once in a while, I'd even get brave enough to call Crawford about some question about something that I was reading, and he was always very generous with his his time too. It's always intimidating to talk to Crawford.
He just knows so much.
Exactly. And I just thought, I don't know anything. And that was always my worry when I was making this transition doing cultural studies in my department, but also doing this other transition to trying to catch up on all the African studies, you know, the literature in all these different fields, you know, because there isn't a good communications literature that's on Africa. I mean, it's all very descriptive stuff. And so what I was reading was came out of literature programs or came out of sociology, you know, sociological theory or, you know, other parts. And so I just felt like I had to learn so much more that I was at a real disadvantage, that I didn't have a field that was central to African studies as, you know, as this interdisciplinary program, intellectual community. And so I just felt like I had to read everything in everybody's discipline so that I would know something. And I probably still don't know, I still feel insecure about what I know about African studies writ large. But
Well, I think almost everybody would,
yeah.
But Crawford.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
But I'm sure Crawford would say there are many, many fields that he knows absolutely nothing about.
Yeah. So, and I studied Wolof at one point.
You went on the St. Louis exchange.
I did for many, many years, and I was involved for about 10 years as the faculty advisor.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim also did, Delahanty also did a lot of the advising for the Senegal program, but mm-hmm. I was also, they always need a faculty.
Someone that has the faculty. Yeah, right.
So I was one of the faculty director for many, many years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I was working in Senegal quite a lot. And that's when, that was kind of almost post-tenure, so 96, 97 in that area.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been to Nigeria several times. And the last time I had been there was when Baba Ngida was supposed to, they were having the elections, and Baba Ngida was supposed to leave, and Abiola had been elected, and then they declared the elections null and void. And my daughter was with me during, we were there for about 4 months, and she was with me during that whole time.
Where were you?
We were up in Jos and some in Lagos, and I was supposed to be teaching at Jos, and of course everything closed down.
So
I was going to be teaching actually in the poli-sci department there,
and
everything closed down, and so the teaching was gone. And then I was doing a lot of interviewing of journalists because I was working on a project then about war coverage of the war in Liberia. So how did Americans think about and were covering the war in Liberia?
Mm-hmm.
And how were Nigerian journalists covering the war in Liberia? Because ECOWAS and ECOMOG were both involved at that point in Liberia.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to have a sense of, do Africans or do Nigerian journalists have a different sensibility about what's happening in Liberia versus the grand stereotypes or tropes that Americans always use to talk about Liberia? So I was working on that project and interviewing a lot of journalists and so forth. And then the elections came and went, and people I knew had interviewed were jailed. Some people just weren't turning up for work. Some newspapers were closed. And so I never really did anything with that project. I had gobs of stuff collected in interviews, but I was always worried that using it, I don't think anybody told me anything that could be compromising, but I was really still worried ethically that there might be something and I might not know what it is. And so just nothing came of that project.
Mm-hmm.
And that was hard to explain, when you're doing your annual activities report and the whole merit exercise. It was hard to explain to my department that you do field work and sometimes just not much comes out of it. And it's because of these other kinds of conditions that you have no control over. And that was hard. And to this day, doing that kind of field work is kind of suspect for my department.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the only person who really does that.
Uh-huh.
And it's always seen as, well, why would you go waste your time if you're not going to actually get something out of it every time?
Yeah.
Or just the idea that it takes a long, long time to establish a site, to get to know people, to get their trust, to be able to talk to people and to actually understand what it is that they're telling you and being able to put it in the right historical and political context and not screw that up as you're writing about your topic. That's been a huge challenge. And that's, after I got tenure, I started doing more and more of this kind of field-based work.
Mm-hmm.
And I was first doing it in Nigeria, then that didn't pan out. And so I just thought, okay. Nigeria is just, it's too hard, it's too hectic, maybe that's just not the spot. And then I started going to Senegal, to St. Louis, and I was working, that was fun. I did a couple of fun projects there in which I was looking at satellite television because the Senegalese government, this is during an era in which the World Bank and IMF were going around to West African countries saying, You've got to open up your broadcast sectors, radio and television in particular, but also print media. If you want to continue to get loans from us, mm-hmm. you need to think about democratization. And one part of democratization is opening up your media sectors, particularly broadcasting and radio and television part. And so Senegal had gone through that, where they had decided that, yes, they were going to allow some privatization of radio. They were not going to privatize television quite yet. They were going to hold on to that as a government-operated organization. But they were going to allow French satellite television into the country. And so I did a lot of work sort of talking to people about French satellite television, mm-hmm. what they were watching and why, would you choose Senegalese television over French satellite TV, and why not, and people's preferences for different kinds of television shows, uh-huh. and what television yeah. meant to them. But I also found a really interesting a bunch of material in the archives about what Senghor had to say about television in the early 1960s, because Senegal was part of a United Nations experiment to create television systems in various parts of West Africa to see what they could do in terms of teaching people, you know, adult education, literacy, yeah. or getting people to boil water, or get their kids vaccinated, or send their children to school, those kinds of campaigns. And Senegal was one of those sites where the UN was running this kind of experimental, let's set up a television system and see how it works and see if anybody pays attention to it. And it operated a couple of years in Senegal, and then the money dried up, and the Senegalese just said, enough of that. Mm-hmm. And then television, maybe 8 years or so, got started again. But Senghor was not... He was not thrilled with the idea of having television in Senegal. Politically, yeah. it was, I think, a little dangerous for him. He wanted to have that control over television, mm-hmm. and that was going to take a lot to keep control over television. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He also just thought it's popular culture. That's all that's going to be on television, yeah. mm-hmm. And you know, his writings about it was just, you know, it's the little screen. What is the little screen going to teach us? We're not going to be able to do ballet on the little screen. You know, it's just going to be it's going to be soap operas and Western cowboy and Indian films that he would talk about. Uh-huh. And he said, we just don't need that in Senegal. And so he was dismissive of the idea of having that television system.
Yeah.
The people, especially the elites, were writing back to him and saying, listen, everyone else in the world's got TV. We need to have TV too. We're never going to be seen as modern unless we have a TV system. So there was this interesting little body of... I happened to just accidentally come across it in the archives. So I did, you know, several years of looking at that stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then... late 90s or so, I was on one of these study abroad trips checking up on students in the Saint Louis program.
Oh, yeah.
As we did every January to see were they going to class, were they working on their research projects, were they learning French, were they learning Wolof. Mm-hmm. So checking up on them, and then I was asked to go by Joan Raduga, I think, to also check up on the program in Ghana, which is not our program, but it was a CIE program, and they just uh-huh. wanted an official UW visit to check up on it. Mm-hmm. And so I said, sure, I'll do that. And I had never been to Ghana before, and this was late January, early February, because it was kind of a funny time because students weren't coming back. I had to miss a few days of classes in order to make these two trips. Uh-huh. But there was Valentine's Day happening in Ghana, and I thought, oh, this would be really fun to be able to come back here and find out why people are celebrating Valentine's Day and how do they do it and what does it mean to them. Mm-hmm. And so I came back and did several months in January mostly, and then came back also sometimes in the summer to just learn about the media system and make connections with people. Mm-hmm. And then I spent, I had maybe a semester where I wasn't teaching or something. I certainly wasn't on sabbatical. But I spent about 8 weeks in January and February around Valentine's Day one year, just talking to people about Valentine's Day, young people, old people, hanging out in shops that were selling Valentine's cards and flowers mm-hmm. and candies and that sort of thing. And then also talking to, the media were really heavily pushing Valentine's Day, and so I wanted to find out what the deal was with that.
Yeah.
And so it turned out to be kind of a cultural analysis of people's ideas about love and romance and gender expectations all within uh-huh. that scope of Valentine's Day. But it was also a political economy of television and radio mm-hmm. because they were really pushing Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
And it was also connected, as in Senegal, to the IMF and World Bank saying, if you want to democratize, you've got to open up your broadcast sector. And so their story was, well, we do a lot of stuff on Valentine's Day because it gets a lot of listeners and viewers in, because Valentine's Day is something that Ghanaians can really connect with. Mm-hmm. And so this is a period, just like Christmas, they would say it's, there are two periods where they make a lot of money and it pays for the rest of the year. And so I did that. And then when I got connected there, I met people at the Center for Democracy and Development, and they were getting ready to do this Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Ghana to look at what happened during the Rawlings years and a little bit into the Nkrumah years. And so I was asked to get involved with helping to train journalists to get ready to cover the Truth and Reconciliation hearings. And so I started doing a lot of work with those journalists in terms of training, but also as the hearings were going on, talking to them about how they were covering the stories and what kinds of pressures political pressures did they feel themselves under.
It must have been fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, that was a lot of fun. I would go to those hearings, you know, every day and just sit with up in the journalist galley. And plus, for an outsider, you know, everyone in Ghana, all these reporters knew everybody who was coming in to give testimony, and they knew all about, oh, they're related to so-and-so, and their cousin is so-and-so, and their, you know, mother-in-law is so-and-so. And so they could put together this huge, big picture that as an outsider, and I still didn't totally understand. I would have never understood.
Yeah.
But then when they would connect it to, I can't say this or report this about this particular person and what they've just said because this person is married to my publisher's sister's cousin, you know, and go through this whole thing.
Yeah.
And so it was really revealing about, you think you know what journalistic constraints are, and then when you're sitting with mostly men, but a few women up there, you really learn how it's a very different world of constraints that you understand.
Yeah.
And then I've been doing that in Liberia since, it's a very similar kind of project in Liberia since then.
Yeah.
So that would be about, I could go on, but it's... not that interesting.
On the contrary, I just think it's very, very interesting. But, one thing we should certainly do at some point is have you talk a little bit more
about the program
on campus and your, you know, you've played some administrative roles and
too much administration for my department's liking. So right after I got tenure. Which was, 1996 or so? I can't remember. It appears on my Vita.
Okay, we'll get
that. What the promotion day was.
Yeah.
Right at that point, my marriage was failing. It was a mess. I got a phone call from Tom Spear saying, we'd like you to be the next director. And I said, but Tom, I don't even consider myself really an Africanist. Yes, I come every Wednesday faithfully to the sandwich seminars, yeah, and I learn a lot. And yes, yeah, I attend the ASA annual meetings. And yes, I try to read up on everything I can read up on Africa so that I can have some credibility. But really, Tom, I'm not like you. Yeah. I don't really consider myself an Africanist. I don't really even speak an African language. And Tom laughed and said, "Bah, I don't either." And I said, "Well, why? Why would you want me?" And he said, "Well, frankly, people who are more senior to you are going to be on sabbatical or won't do it." And so I appreciated Tom's honesty about. And Tom also, I really became a mentor of sorts at that time too. Because it was maybe about a year or so before he knew that his term was going to be up. And so I think they were just kind of floating around trying to find who might be available, who might be willing to do this.
Yeah.
And he said, "You can come with me to some meeting in Washington, Title VI meeting in Washington. Come with me and you can see what it's like and I can explain this stuff to you." And, I said, I'm not really. And he said, "You're Africanist enough." Whatever you're going to do, he said, "You're going to have an associate director who's actually going to do all your thinking for you." So, you just need, he said, it's the usual faculty thing. They just need you to sign some documents every once in a while and to not screw up anything. So, we think that you can probably sign documents and not screw up anything too much. So I went to some meeting with Tom in Washington he kept at me, talking to me about, "Would I do this?" And I'd come back with somebody, "Oh, no, they're going to be on sabbatical, too." It was clear all the good people were on sabbatical otherwise occupied in doing something else, that I was really kind of it. And with my marriage breaking up, I thought, well, this is not a terrible thing, because there's a nice office over in Ingram Hall. And I can spend my time over at Ingram Hall rather than in Vilas Hall.
Two doors away or
two
something.
Doors, and it literally was. My ex-husband's,
what, was it really,
my ex-husband's office was two doors away from mine.
I just said that.
No, it was in fact two doors away from mine. And I thought, this is, I don't want to be in this department now.
Yeah.
And this is going to be horrible.
Yeah.
It never occurred to me that I might actually ask to move to another department. I didn't even know you could do such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, okay, I'm going to do this African studies thing, even though I'm quite skeptical of my ability to do this, just because I need to get out of my department. And my mentor, Bob Drexel, in the department said, "Well, just don't get..." He was the chair at that time and had done a fabulous job as chair of the school. But it had really, administration had just eaten away his research and that's what he was doing. Plus the department was falling apart in its own ways. And we've always been a fractious department. He was putting out his whole set of fires himself. So they said, don't let this just overtake your life.
Yeah.
So I decided, for lots of reasons, that it was a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became the director, 97, I guess it was. And I think African Studies at that point, it was humming along. It was, doing well. We had always done well in Title VI competitions. Tom had gotten, done well.
Mm-hmm.
He and Jim had done well in the last Title VI competition.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So I felt that was pretty secure.
Yeah.
But I had ideas that I wanted to try to make the program a little bit bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Try to get more faculty from different more disciplines,
mm-hmm.
and from professional schools, so the med school or vet school or law school and other places like that. So Jim and I did a lot of sort of knocking on the doors.
Jim Delahanty.
Yeah, Jim Delahanty and I did a lot of sort of knocking on the doors of and contacting people across campus and saying, hey, we see you're a Peace Corps in such and such place.
Yeah.
You know, we have an African Studies program here. Here's the kind of thing that we could, we could do for you. Or even people, Ellen Cepeda, for instance, who's in Spanish and Portuguese and who's been now the director for European Studies. Ellen was, I didn't know her very much at all, but she had said something in a meeting where I was, where she was interested in Cabo Verde. So I mentioned to her, well, you know, I'm the director of African Studies. Maybe we could get some money somehow for you to go visit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we did. And that was sort of the beginning of Ellen's career doing not just Iberian studies and Brazilian studies, but also then getting interested in Cape Verde and Mozambique and Angola, doing more work there.
Yeah.
Luis Madureira, who was from Mozambique, getting him sort of back into thinking about African diaspora and you know, Atlantic or different connections between Africa and South America and so forth, and Portugal. So we tried to think of some ways of getting new faculty into the program, and it was just a little bit of seed money here and there. It was kind of what Betty Wass did for me.
It was not
an imaginative idea on my part. It was Betty got me interested by getting me there, and if we can get some faculty there, then in the long run that should pay off. We'll have lots of different faculty from different disciplines and different backgrounds, and that'll make the program more vibrant. So I mean, that was one of the things that we did. And then Tom Spear had worked on the cluster proposal for the African diaspora hires. And that did get funded the first time around, and I went back and did a little tinkering, a little revising, but it was really Tom's proposal.
Hmm.
But that happened when I was chair and I served on the committee, and you know, we hired Tejo Alani on in that hire. You know, so we made some nice hires, and we brought, I think, some new blood into the program. And then Title VI, we did quite well for whatever reason that particular year. And so
part of it was probably the development of BRIC. Right?
I think it was. That we could say that
was always a very important point of competition, really.
It was, and we had also done SCALI for a few years, and we kind of pushed SCALI out and made it a little bit. That's the African Language Institute training program during the summer months, and we made it a little bit bigger, and we'd also, you know, because we worked with different universities to get them to give, you know, a little bit more here and then. You know, it's complicated, boring administrative things, but we got more money for SCALI, and because of that, we were able to expand the number of languages that we were able to offer, and I think that helped us also in the Title VI proposal as well. And we did things like one of the SCALIs we offered Afrikaans. I don't think it's ever been offered again.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I remember talking to Heinz Klug and other people on campus about how would you feel about Afrikaans being listed as an African language, and it was a little controversial. So Heinz said, "Yeah, fine." And other people, Dan Kinney was very, I think, upset with us for doing that, and for understandable reasons. But it was also at one of those times that we had a lot of students who were working in South Africa because of the not so recent transition, and they needed to read documents in Afrikaans, taking Dutch classes on campus was just not doing it for them. And so I really felt like, well, let's see what we can do. I don't think we've done that since. So now we have Zulu and Xhosa, so that's good. That was another expansion that we tried to do along with the Afrikaans. What else? I think we had, we used to have the spring, what were those called? The spring seminars? I remember it was like 2 or 3 day conferences, those little things.
Where we would bring in people from
other
campuses.
Yeah, so you know, I think we tried to make those more sort of accessible to the public.
Uh-huh. That's a good idea.
Yeah, that was one of our ideas of just making them not just academic conferences, but also more accessible.
Yeah, as we had done those earlier, I never thought it was as successful as we would have.
Yeah.
Or valuable as
a right, and I think there are a couple that we felt like were pretty good.
We did establish some good contacts with some people at other campuses, but
So in terms of what I did in African Studies, it's really the faculty and the staff did in African Studies in those years.
Anyway,
as Tom said, I signed papers and I didn't screw anything up. That was about it. But I tried to be also, because I was always in that office because I didn't want to be in my office in Vilas, I think I became one of the directors who I really understood.
More hands-on than many.
Yeah, I was probably more hands-on in a lot of ways and really learned a lot about Title VI and how it worked and really learned probably too much, probably against what Bob Drexel was telling me, my mentor, my department was telling me, don't get too involved in this stuff. I probably got too involved in this stuff. And probably to the detriment of research productivity. But I just found it interesting. And I always felt like I was doing something good for other faculty and other staff. You build a vibrant program.
Yeah.
And that's good. It's good for students and it's good for faculty and staff.
You do it by helping other people.
And so you feel like you're helping other people. Yeah. And service doesn't get particularly rewarded on campus, but I always liked it because I felt like I was doing something good for other people.
It's its own reward.
Yeah, I felt like I was doing something good for other people.
Yeah.
And then that led me to doing, I was then asked to chair the Global Studies program.
Mm-hmm.
And it had not gotten in the previous Title VI. It was, you were part of it. You were part of Global Studies when it was what was it called back then? The International Studies Joint Center? The Milwaukee-Madison International Studies Program?
Yeah,
and you were you were doing, didn't you write some of those Title VI grants?
I certainly was involved. I can't remember.
Yeah.
I definitely was involved in that.
I think you were.
In that program, and I often went to Milwaukee and worked with Mark Tesler.
That's right. And Mark
was a really excellent political scientist and specialist.
And then he left.
Yeah.
So this is after, I think, that whole program kind of broke up.
Okay.
So I don't think you were involved in it much anymore.
No,
and Mark Tesler had left,
Michigan
or Arizona or one of those
someplace places. In the West,
So he had left. And so we decided that we were going to go for Global, and it didn't get funded the last time round.
Uh-huh.
It was written by not an academic, but an academic staff member who was working for Trubac.
Uh-huh.
She didn't know what she was doing.
Yeah.
And so it didn't get funded. So we decided that we would go in for a Title VI grant for Global Studies. And that must have been at the waning days of Trubac. It must have been just as Gilles Bousquet was coming in. He wanted another little
just
federal.
A little bit after 2000.
Yeah, maybe 2001 or so.
Uh-huh.
And Gilles wanted another little feather in his cap so he could say that we've got 9 or 8, whatever the number is.
Title VI centers.
Yeah, Title VI centers. And the Global Studies program, writing those grants are different from the Area Studies because when you're doing African Studies, you just have to write about Africa.
Yeah.
That's your focus. And what are you going to do that's interesting and important for your faculty and staff and students that relates to Africa? It's kind of, you got to come up with good ideas for what you're going to do, but it's Africa. It's very centered. For Global Studies or International Studies proposal, you had to come up with some kind of theme.
Mm-hmm.
And this was right after 9/11. And so because our theme, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was one of these themes that has no real meaning but sounds good. It was something like global citizenship and human security and something else. But I had developed this theme and figured out what I thought was the formula for writing this particular kind of grant and got started on it. Now here's the part that might be a little controversial, but it's fine, I don't care. Bousquet thought he was going to control what I was writing because he thought if we got this Title VI grant, that would help fund whatever he was doing in the division. And I didn't see it quite that way. I thought this grant and this center would be like every other area studies center. We were going to be, more or less autonomous.
Sure.
I mean, the other area studies centers like African Studies is part of LNS. Mm-hmm. Global Studies had always been part of the division. Yeah. That was Trubeck's Empire Building.
It was, yes.
So that was the result of that. So,
refer to my interview.
Yes, refer to Paul's interview. The groundbreaking, and so Gilles just thought, well, this is going to be a continuation of this. Like Dave used the MacArthur and the Ford Foundation funds for various objectives that he had in the division.
Yeah.
Much of that money coming through Global Studies. Bousquet thought he would use Title VI funds in those way, in that way too, and so he interfered constantly in the writing of this thing, and he would email me with suggestions, and I would say, Gilles, if I do that, that's against Title VI rules. I can't give undergraduates money for scholarships to go abroad. It's just if you do that, we'll be disqualified. And he would get angry about these things. He wanted me to make Chinese a last language, and I'd say, but they're doing that in East Asian studies. And so it was a constant fight. And I think part of it was he thought Cynthia Williams would actually be
the director,
his person, his person writing the grant.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And I wasn't going to let that happen because she didn't get the grant the first time around.
Right.
Why would I let her write it this time?
Yeah.
But he wanted her to write it because he would have more control over its content.
Yeah.
Of course, if she had written it and if she had used his content, they wouldn't have gotten it.
Yeah.
Because he didn't really understand the regulations of Title VI, what was acceptable and what wasn't acceptable for Title VI. So we got off to we got the grant. I knew we would get the grant. When I turned in the proposal, I thought, this is a good grant, we're going to get it.
Yeah.
And we had been discouraged by Washington, actually, of turning in a proposal, because Milwaukee also wanted to put in a proposal, but a separate one for us. And so the idea was, we can't have two international study centers in the state of Wisconsin. The way it worked out is that Milwaukee had one of these undergraduate programs, and we had the full in our National Resource Center, and just like African Studies was a National Resource Center. So we got the whole ball of wax. I turned in the proposal, and I thought, we're going to get this. This is not going to be a problem. Don't know about Milwaukee, don't care. But I'm pretty sure I was 95% sure that we would get it. I just felt good about it.
Yeah.
And I got an email I had to submit it through Bousquet's office, and I got an email the next day saying this isn't worth the paper that's written on. And that was his line with everybody that he talked to the entire year before we heard the news that we had gotten it. He told Trubeck that. He told various faculty. I know it because I heard it from other faculty who would say, Dean Bousquet said this and this and this. It wasn't worth the paper that it was written on. And I thought, that's just like my email that I got.
Yeah.
And then we got it.
Yeah.
And then he never said congratulations. And we had, it was difficult working with him because he still wanted to try to use our funds for things that you weren't supposed to use Title VI funds for in the division. And so I had to make it very clear to he and Kathy Mashevitz that our budget, the Title VI budget, was not their budget, and that they were going to funnel money through it. and that we were going to keep track of it, mm-hmm. and that we were going to spend it and be accountable for the Title VI money for Global Studies faculty and students, yeah. that we were the ones who were going to take charge of this thing. And that was, I'm glad I did it. It was mm-hmm. hard to do. Mm-hmm. It meant that I only stayed on there for 2 years as director because I just couldn't stand it. Uh-huh. Like I was uh-huh. not going to do a third year. I just could yeah. not stand uh-huh. it. But in doing what I did, Global Studies then became an independent, or more or less an independent uh-huh. entity.
Yeah.
I mean, it had to be done.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so I'm glad I did that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was not fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it
must have been rough.
It was horrible. I've never been treated so badly,
mm-hmm.
And just had so many uncalled for. But so I went away, and after doing that, I think maybe I had a sabbatical. After that.
Where are we in time now?
We would be about 2003.
2003, yeah.
2003, mm-hmm. yeah. So then I went on sabbatical mm-hmm. 2003, 2004, somewhere mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. there. Came back from sabbatical and really didn't also, so I was divorced by then as well, but I really wasn't pleased about being back in my department full time again. And that was also one of the reasons why I took the Global Studies job.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Was also
yeah.
my yeah. wanting to not be in the department.
Yeah.
So uh-huh. I was on sabbatical, I came back, I was right there in the department
yeah.
again.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh, I just don't know if I'm ready to be in the department again
yeah.
full
uh-huh.
time.
Yeah.
Because now, even though I was divorced, you've got child custody things have gone on.
Yeah.
You know, uh-huh. really, she's with me 90% of the
yeah.
time. But you know,
how old was Mela at
Mela
that time?
Mela was a freshman in high school.
Oh,
by then,
mm-hmm.
And she had real troubles her freshman year in high school. It
mm-hmm.
was, I think, very, very difficult transition
yeah.
for her.
Yeah,
and that meant I had. When I was on sabbatical, I didn't go to do the field work I wanted to do in Ghana because she absolutely refused to stay with her father at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so my field trips were,
yeah.
I wasn't going to be able, I couldn't
yeah.
make them. I wasn't
yeah.
going to force her to go someplace.
Yeah.
And it just would have made things worse.
Yeah.
And so I was sort of her, at my house, was her place of stability, and that's
yeah.
you know, so
yeah.
that's what we did on
yeah.
my sabbatical.
Yeah.
Was you know, I helped her get through that freshman year.
Yeah.
And she it was difficult for her. You know, in ways just yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of things that
yeah.
you know, you just wouldn't want to happen to
yeah.
again. So I finished up my sabbatical about 2004 or so. Came back to the department. I thought, oh God, I can't do this. I can't be here. I'm gonna wring my ex-husband's neck. And we'd gotten some new faculty members by then too, who were also a couple of male faculty members who were very, very forceful, very powerful in the department, but had their own vested interests and were not interested in doing things for the good of the department, but
mm-hmm.
were interested in doing good things for themselves.
Uh-huh.
And again, the department began splintering and fracturing in
yeah.
ways, and,
uh-huh.
and it was just an unpleasant place to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mary Layoun called me and said, I'm stepping down from being faculty director of Chadbourne. You want to do that? And I thought, I'll do anything at this point. I mean, it was not the ideal appointment to,
yeah.
for me. I think,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
at Chadbourne Residential College, I think you need someone who's much more extroverted and likes to be with kids and horse around and, you know, all that kind
yeah.
of stuff. And but I said yes because I wanted to get out of my department. And they had this great office in Chadbourne that I could go
yeah.
hide
yeah.
in.
Yeah.
But even at Chadbourne, I think I did some okay, good things.
Mm-hmm.
We had some student trips civil rights trips to the South that we took
mm-hmm.
that were good. We got we were trying to do something where we could combine South Africa and a trip to the South, and that never quite sort of panned out. Fired a couple academic staff members who needed to be fired. They're probably eternally grateful for me, for doing that, because that needed to happen long ago, and nobody was going to do it. And then I did that for a couple of years, and I was enjoying it, but it was, you know, it was a stretch for me, but I was enjoying it. I felt like I was doing a good job. But then John Peavy House, who's in political science, he was the director of the International Studies major. And he called me and he said, I'm not an administrator. I can't stand this stuff. I hate being director. Will you come and do this? And I thought, now this is more, I could get back into doing international studies stuff, and area studies work, and being with all my friends and colleagues that I knew from my days in African studies and global studies, and people I like to hang out with, and faculty I like to hang out with and learn from. And so I said, sure, I'll do that. And so I was director of the International Studies major for about almost 6 years.
Okay.
And we got, you know, we sort of made the major more coherent, and we got resources from the college from it. And we got, you know, a couple full-time advisors. We made some MIU hires. You know, so we were able to build up the program a little bit and make it coherent. And you know, the program continues to grow. It's one of the largest in the college. You know, I think when I was director, it was the sixth or seventh largest in the college. And then we also needed, that was a ton of work, being the director of the International Studies major. For a long time, it was just me and the academic advisor. And she had so many students that she was advising that she didn't have time to do what a lot of administrative staff would do, like timetabling. And so I was doing timetabling as a faculty member and not really knowing what I was doing. So it occurred to me that we really needed administrative help. So I went up to Global Studies and I said, why don't we form a coalition? You know, maybe not a formal merger. Why don't we form a coalition where we can share resources of one type or another? And so in the last couple of years that I was director, we had this coalition with Global Studies, which was really nice because Steve Smith, whom I helped to hire when he first came in to Global Studies, did a lot of work that I no longer had to do as a faculty member that I was terrible at, you know, doing and handling a lot of administrative just headaches. And he was very good at that. And then we shared various advising, you know, things with Global Studies, and so Global Studies also felt like they could claim us for their Title VI purposes, and so it was a nice arrangement. And then Global Studies, when I was just ending up my term, also took in, as part of the coalition, the Development Studies PhD program. So now it's all one happy sort of functioning coalition. So is that enough on...
That brings us up, what, to about 2010?
To like 2011, right now.
To right now. Yeah, okay.
And since, I miss being in an area studies program more closely than I am. My department now holds all of its faculty meetings on Wednesdays at noon, and I cannot get them to change. And so I miss all the sandwich seminars, which are no longer sandwich seminars. But I miss all those, and I miss that contact, because African studies I always considered to be really my intellectual home. Because there were people from all sorts of different disciplines that I could talk to about my work that was quite interdisciplinary. And it always had a lot of energy. There were always new, good graduate students from lots of different departments. There were always new, good faculty members that were coming in and participating in the program. And even the geezers like us were, you know, there were lots of interesting, you know, we're still doing lots of really interesting work. And so I always felt like I was learning something and participating in a really vibrant community.
Yeah.
And I haven't been able to do that as much as I'd like to in the last couple of years because we held faculty meetings, our department being a fractious department, we have faculty meetings virtually every Wednesday.
Yeah.
And I feel like as a good citizen, I need to turn up for those, but it makes it hard.
Do you have any particular perspective on, say, the next decade? And, any vision for yourself?
Well, right now I'm serving on the university committee, and this is my first year on the university committee. And again, it's one of those service commitments. You do it because you believe in the principle of shared governance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's unrewarded, but it is a very rewarding committee. I really feel like we're doing something good.
Yeah.
Now, how did I get on the university committee? I had no plans for doing that, except I got a phone call from the chair of the committee last year saying, we want you to run.
Yeah.
And why he wanted me to run was... Here's one of our delicate moments. For years, people had trouble with Gilles Bousquet as Dean of the Division of International Studies. People were not satisfied with how he was running things, his initiatives, how they were funded. There was no faculty input into what he was doing. There was no faculty say in whether we wanted the division to be spending money on this or that initiative.
Yeah.
And finally, when Title VI came under, when it was being cut, when it took those the hit a few years back and was cut by 50%, and we were trying to work out, and this is still when I was director of Global Studies, so what was that, 2010 or so?
Oh,
When there was all those cuts.
Yeah.
And so we were doing, you know, new budgets every month, trying to figure out how not to lay off people and how to still be able to fulfill some of our goals in terms of programming or, you know, reaching faculty and helping faculty teach courses that we thought were valuable courses.
Yeah.
And I remember at one meeting, sort of an APC meeting that Bousquet was holding, you know, he just threw up his hands and he says, well, you know, Title VI is your problem, it's not my problem, and, you know, I don't need to bail you all out, you know, it's your problem. and that's just when everyone, if he hadn't said it, and if he hadn't said it in the way that he did, where he just sat back and threw up his hands and said, well, it's your problem, you deal with it, he might have gotten away with it, but saying it the way what he said and how he said it, that was it. People were angry. And that's when Catherine Bowie from Southeast Asian Studies began to float the idea of a petition. Let's let the administration know that we're not happy with this guy's with this guy's tenure. Now this, we were long not happy with his tenure. When he came up for his five-year review, I and another faculty member went to John Wiley, who was then chancellor, and went to Patrick Farrell, who was then provost, and said, you've got to appoint a real committee to review this guy, because we're telling you there are real problems there. There are real governance problems there. And we think there are probably budget problems as well, but we know there are real governance problems because there was no governance. There was no faculty governance. There was no shared governance. And they didn't appoint a real committee. They appointed a whitewash committee, and that's exactly what they got. And he got through his five-year review. But when he did this bit about Title VI cuts are your problem, I don't need to do anything to help, Catherine brought up the idea of doing this petition. And within a day, there were 135 signatories on that petition. Saying, get rid of this guy. You know, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's not helpful. He's, you know, it was, and I approached Brad Barham, who was then chair of the UC. We were on another committee together. And I approached him as this petition was going to go up to David Ward, who was then interim chancellor, his first year of interim chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
I approached Brad and I said, there are governance issues. I don't know that petition's going to really get at the governance issues.
Yeah.
It might just say that, you know, and it did say Bousquet is bad and he needs to go.
But
I said, the reason he's bad and needs to go is because of governance.
Yeah.
There is no governance. And that's what the UC needs to look into.
Yeah.
So the UC had Catherine Bowie, Sonia Billowy from Latin American Studies, and me in to talk to them about what was going on in the Division of International Studies and the Title VI cuts.
Uh-huh.
And we did that. And I came in with a long prepared statement because I had lots of things to say from lots of years of dealing with Bousquet.
Yeah.
And on the basis of our visit with the UC appointed an ad hoc committee to begin to study the division and governance issues within the division. And it was very clear from our mandate that this was not a personnel review.
Yeah.
This was a review of governance issues within the division and the International Institute, to which all the area studies programs belong to the International Institute.
Uh-huh.
And so we did that report. Chris Olds was the chair, and I was there, and other faculty from campus. And basically our finding was, because we couldn't make it into a personnel review, the division needs to go away. The institute needs to go away. All the area study centers should just be merged be put in LNS. Just pack it in. Get rid of the whole thing. There doesn't need to be a vice chancellor for international, whatever it was that the vice provost was doing, international travel, or what is international Chinese initiatives, or there doesn't need to be a vice provost position for that. Get rid of all of that. Which was the committee's way of saying, get rid of Bousquet.
Mm-hmm.
Because we knew perfectly well that they were not actually going to get rid of those structures.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was not going to happen.
Yeah.
But it was our way of being able to say, if you get rid of all these structures, then you don't need the guy who's in charge of all those structures.
Yeah.
So it was the only way that we could figure out to say, get rid of him.
Yeah.
And the chancellor and provost were not pleased about the report because they had to deal with it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was posted publicly. Dave Trubeck wrote a long letter that was also posted publicly on the secretary of faculty side about how this committee was a rogue committee and this and that. And Jill wrote a little something about this committee being a rogue committee and so forth. But then all of a sudden, Gilles was going to Eau Claire as the interim president or chancellor of Eau Claire. And that was a worked out deal. David Ward was very clear that that's what they were going to do.
Yeah.
They felt like they couldn't fire him because there was a contract that Gilles had for 5 more years and they owed him another year. Mm-hmm. And so this was going to be a year that wasn't going to count against him for that 5-year period, but it was a way of getting him out of here for a year.
Yeah.
And then seeing what could be done to reorganize area studies on campus and reorganize the division and also to figure out funding models that might work in a world in which Title VI funds have been drastically cut or may not exist at all.
Yeah. It's actually now a very interesting time.
Yes.
Isn't it? For in something that is without any precedent, in any of our memories. Even somebody like me.
That wouldn't have happened if Bousquet had been around.
Yeah. But we have that happening. We have the legacy of Dave Trubeck, which certainly gives things to work with.
Right,
Perhaps in different ways than.
In
fact, quite different ways probably than his. And then this sudden change in federal funding.
Dave was no friend to shared governance either. I mean, Dave was not interested at all in shared governance, but I think faculty who participated in the area studies programs and directors of the area studies programs were all kind of willing to put up with Dave's lack of shared governance, interest in shared governance, because Dave was smart. Mm-hmm. And Dave could at least get us to go along with interesting things that he had planned, or that he was bringing in money from Ford and MacArthur. So people could kind of put up with that. But when Bousquet was also not interested in shared governance and was not interested in sharing funds with the area studies programs, or was in fact competing sometimes with the area studies programs. For instance, Global Studies, we had a dissertation fieldwork award. He set up another one that competed with ours for funders, because he wanted one for, you know, for the division. I mean, it's just that kind of insane stuff. And I think if Scheel had been around as well, Gary Sandifer wouldn't have worked with Guido Podesta, who was the interim dean for the Division of International Studies, and he wouldn't have worked with him to get Mellon money in here. That just wouldn't have happened. Sandifer would not have worked, I don't think, with with Bousquet to bring in that extra funding. And without that funding from Mellon, these centers, we would have been laying off people. We would be doing, we are doing much less than what we used to do, but we are figuring out ways of using the Mellon money and sort of working to find efficiencies and ways of working with each other so that we can save funds, so that we can eventually come out of this and still do lots of good things for faculty and students and staff on campus. So it's those are hard times, but I also I think they've come out with some good things. And the UC, the university committee, is still now quite interested in what's happening with the Division of International Studies, so has been watching the reorganization fairly closely, and has been watching what's happening with the Mellon money, what's happening with creation of shared governance groups. Will be involved in probably the search process for a new dean, has been involved in other, little facets of study abroad that hadn't been quite governed or quite transparent. And so I think really the UC sort of opening that up has really allowed the area studies programs to also become more transparent and also have more say in what it is that they want to do and how structures, what kinds of structures will work best in the end. So my initial report is, question was, how did I get on the UC? It was because of this ad hoc committee. So, and I think that's, what else? What else can there be?
Well,
I think that takes us up to May 14th, 2013.
Okay. That's today.
Yes.
Well, it's really... so I think I'll turn this off.
Okay.